Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Victims of that data breach at Target could get up to $10,000 each. And as March Madness sets in, bracket headaches for bosses. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 19th of March, and it's great to have you with us. Target is settling a class action lawsuit over its 2013 data breach. A judge has given the settlement preliminary approval. Hackers stole credit card numbers and personal information from tens of millions of customers, and Target wants to establish a $10 million fund for victims. They would be eligible for damages up to $10,000. The structure of the settlement is unusual, and as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, it could set a precedent for other data theft cases.
It was back in the 2013 holiday shopping season when hackers stole credit and debit card information of up to 40 million Target shoppers. That breach has already cost Target well over $100 million in security upgrades, legal fees, and such. So a $10 million settlement doesn't seem like that much.
It does seem like a small pot of money when you consider how many consumers were actually victimized by the Target breach.
Ed Mierzwinski is with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group in Washington, D.C. He says the settlement is significant because
Target is admitting that data breaches cause real consumer harms.
Mierzwinski says this is the first time a company of this size has admitted that. Bill McGeverin teaches privacy and security law for the University of Minnesota.
I think it's a smart move for Target to settle this case at this number.
McGeverin says typically class action settlements pay a very small amount to a lot of people. Instead, the Target deal is offering victims up to $10,000 if they can show proof of harm.
This is different from settlements where everyone gets a small coupon, which is what we've seen frequently in the past.
McGeverin says a $10 million settlement is a price tag Target would gladly pay, and the case could set a precedent for future data security cases.
Settlements are negotiations, and any time another settlement happens, it helps set what is the going price.
Home Depot, take note, a class action suit is currently underway against the company for its 2014 data breach. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The recording industry's revenues were flat last year. That is according to a new report from the Recording Industry Association of America. And for the first time, companies made more money off of streaming music than CDs. Because of the music industry's transformation and because of how much competition there is from other digital sources of entertainment, flat revenue is pretty good, Gigi Duban reports.
Let's go back to the golden days of music sales, about 15 years ago. Revenues were about $14.5 billion. Now the industry brings in half that. Joshua Friedlander is VP of Strategic Data Analysis with the Recording Industry Association.
It's a big drop, but a lot has happened in those years.
First, there was piracy. Then iTunes and Amazon made it easy to buy just one song for a buck, as opposed to an entire CD for maybe $15. That brought music back to the very old days of cheap 45 singles. And then came streaming, which let users listen to music for hours for free, with paid versions of these services optional.
I think there's been an overall competition for people's attention and their time.
Sirona Elton is director of the Music, Business, and Entertainment Studies program at the University of Miami. She says people are spending their time and their money on other things. If you're playing video games or streaming movies online, you're not listening to as much music. Who's suffered the most? Where did those billions go?
I think the first people or the first entities to feel it were definitely the record companies.
But she says there's a trickle-down effect. So the short answer on who in the music business gets the brunt of it is everyone, from the artists to the songwriters, except those making vinyl records. Those sales were up 50%. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets were mixed. Details when we do the numbers. Since the Great Recession, some industries have started to come back, car makers, construction, but other industries have wilted. One of them is the plant nursery business. Before the recession, the USDA says there were around 55,000 nurseries, greenhouses, and floricultural operations. It was a $16 billion industry. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, the landscape is changing.
Another Ohio winter has covered Tip City with a glaze of snow and ice. But in this corner of town, the high is about 80.
So the hellebores are starting to flower.
This is clematis.
These are some blackberries. They're already flowering, sending out flowers.
We're in the greenhouses of Spring Hill Nurseries, and that was Felix Cooper, vice president of Gardens Alive, Spring Hill's parent company, and Jenny Lewis, the greenhouse manager. They sell plants online and through catalogs to customers across the country. The greenhouses here seem endless. Inside them, rows of blood red sedum run next to yellow succulents. Coral bells with hot pink leaves seem to glow. Coolers hold strange tubers shaped like giant grubs.
And all these just started really popping out in the last week or so.
The run-up to spring is the busiest season, and so they crank up the heat to get the buds going.
We can have a $30,000 January on the heating bill.
Over in the warehouse, the musty smell of peat moss hangs in the air as bulbs and roots twirl through conveyor belts and shrink wrap machines into bags to ship to customers.
It's like a factory.
It is. You're just dealing with plants instead of some kind of hard good or nut and bolt.
Spring Hill Nurseries has been around longer than California has been a state. After 166 springs, this may be its last.
It's been a fairly steady, you know, ride down.
Niles Kinnerk is CEO of Gardens Alive. They own several plant businesses and sell environmentally responsible gardening products. Some of their seed companies and bulb companies are doing great, but Spring Hill is draining cash. Kinnerk is trying to sell it.
You know, the alternative for us is to cut way back.
This is the tail end of a nationwide phenomenon that is decades in the making, but came to a head in the Great Recession. Charlie Hall is an agricultural economist at Texas A&M University. He says nurseries ramped up with the housing boom, took out loans to expand, and were left holding the bag.
As many as 30% of the growers in the country exited during this period of financial stress. And that's a significant number of growers.
North Carolina lost 40% of its nursery industry.
Tony Avent runs Plant Delights Nursery in Raleigh.
Garden retailers, wholesalers, Georgia lost 60%.
There's new competition now, too, says Niles Kinnerk of Gardens Alive.
The big box stores have put quite a bit of effort into their green goods areas. They're very competitive, and they've taken a, you know, a good hunk of business that used to be fulfilled by companies like ours.
Credit, especially for smaller companies, is harder to come by.
Back in 2001, the bank was willing to extend to us the, you know, 10 times our earnings. And, you know, now it's down to 3 times earnings.
Federal regulations reining in lending are partly responsible for that. Banks have expanded small business loans as a whole, but plant nurseries' biggest source of collateral is their land, and it's usually not worth much.
I've actually had my banker say to me, you know, well, don't even talk to me about the land value or the building value.
But hovering behind all the economic factors is how America's relationship to its gardens and its plants is changing, says Kinnerk. For one, fewer people grow their own food.
People's size of their yards are getting smaller. Two-income families now, it means they have less time. Gardening takes time.
Last year was a particularly nasty winter. It depressed sales at Spring Hill, and that was a hill too far. Kinnerk needs to use his cash to build his businesses that are growing. He still has faith that Spring Hill can flourish again, but he can't be the one to rescue it. In Dayton, Ohio, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up,
when you're sitting outside on a sunny day eating at a restaurant, you tip more money because of the sunlight. It makes you feel better.
The complicated relationship between our wallets and our brains. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 117 points, 6/10%, ending at 17,959. The NASDAQ gained 9 points, 2/10%, close at $49.92, and the S&P 500 lost 10 points, 0.5%, to finish at $20.89. The country's biggest steel maker, Nucor Corporation, lowered its profit estimate for the first quarter, and shares fell 6.4%. Nucor said it's losing business to imported steel made cheaper by the strong dollar. Commercial metals company of Irving, Texas, which makes and recycles steel, was off 3.4%. Schnitzer Steel Industries, a scrap metal recycler based in Portland, Oregon, slid 2.8%. A.M. Castle & Company, which distributes specialty metals, dropped more than 1%. Steel Dynamics, out of Fort Wayne, produces carbon steel. Its shares off 2.5%. Medical device company Nevro posted a strong fourth-quarter profit after going public, and shares jumped 18%. Nevro makes an electronic spinal stimulator for chronic back pain. Low oil prices pounded the energy sector. Ultra Petroleum, an independent gas and oil producer, fell 7%. Tidewater, which services offshore drilling rigs, was down 8%. And Hess Corporation, a global oil and gas producer, was off more than 3%. European markets were mixed. Britain's FTSE rose 0.25%. France's CAC 40 nudged up less than 0.1%. Germany's DAX lost 0.2%. Bond prices, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.97%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Lights out for the second White House Student Film Festival. This year's theme is service and giving back. The National Cherry Blossom Festival gets underway in the nation's capital, a tradition commemorating the gift of 3,000 Japanese cherry trees in 1912. And brace yourselves, it's time for spring cleaning. You can begin tomorrow. The Almanac says so. Ooh, let's start in the wine cellar. Who needs their wine cellar cleaned? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. Chances are you've heard about fracking and earthquakes. Geologists are opining on links between those two things. In fact, a new paper warns of larger and more damaging quakes in Oklahoma due to seismic faults that have been reactivated. That state's Supreme Court has taken a case that could determine whether oil and gas firms can be held liable for earthquake-related damage. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
This is a personal injury case. 4 years ago in Prague, Oklahoma, a 5.7 tremor struck. Pieces of Sandra Ladra's chimney fell on her leg, and she may have to have a knee replaced. She sued two companies in the fracking wastewater business. The companies inject water underground and, in her view, caused the quake.
First of all, they're going to have to prove the science that there was causation.
That's law professor Josh Ferchet at West Virginia University.
There's definitely science out there that says injection wells can cause earthquakes. The question is, did they in these particular cases?
The ruling could come any day, and industry is watching closely. Fracking produces huge volumes of wastewater. And if the companies lose, Ferchet says,
we'd see a quick move to see industry supporting regulations that tell them what they need to do to avoid liability or at least limit their liability.
One way to lower risk is to check for seismic faults before injecting. Ohio already requires that. Another is to inject more slowly, or inject less by reusing the same water again and again, says consultant Evan Hansen at Downstream Strategies.
More and more of the wastewater is being recycled and reused at other fracking operations. That's a good thing. That cuts down the requirement to dispose of the wastewater.
But it comes down to money. Recycling takes more pipes and treatment. Pre-testing and monitoring injection take more experts. But if there are more big lawsuits or big earthquakes linked to the fracking process, the price of safety may be worth it to industry. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I scrambled a bit this morning to fill out my bracket. I did get it in under the wire. March Madness has set in. The men's NCAA basketball tournament got underway a few hours ago. And even though I grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I picked Kentucky, a big favorite. It's estimated 60 million Americans filled out brackets. And it's also estimated that the productivity drop during this three-week tournament costs nearly $2 billion. That isn't all that's on employers' minds, though. Workplace pools can also lead to trouble with organized labor, as Megan Hughes explains.
Workers in D.C.'s DuPont Circle neighborhood are excited for two things this spring: the chance to eat lunch outside and their workplace NCAA brackets.
people are getting pretty into it.
It's just something that seems like a lot of people are into and can just another activity people can bond over.
I sort of do it on my own time, and I suggest that employers do not allow it to run rampant.
That last fellow, the one that was kind of a downer, that's attorney Gary Lieber. He represents management in labor cases and warns that allowing bracket bets in the workplace may violate what's known as the no solicitation rule. What's that?
Work is for work, and an employer can demand that an employee spend all of its work time dedicated to that employer's operations.
That means no work time solicitation, and that's where unions get a little defensive. Matt Ginsburg, Associate General Counsel for the AFL-CIO, says employers often have a double standard when it comes to enforcement. He says in one case, a judge ruled against an Indiana hospital for interfering with nurses organizing a union while ignoring other violations.
He found examples included solicitations for Girl Scout cookies, March of Dimes, United Way, Secretary's Day, Boss Day, and going away parties.
You heard that right. Girl Scout cookie sales could be cause for complaint.
So do you think March Madness pools could be included on that list?
Particularly if an employer is promoting a March Madness pool, I think that could be one example of solicitation, yes.
He says the AFL-CIO has yet to file any complaints regarding a March Madness pool. But like an attorney, there is no such thing as a sure thing. Kentucky fans, I'm looking at you. In Washington, I'm Megan Hughes for Marketplace.
It's been more than two decades since an NFL team played here in Los Angeles. That could finally change now that not one but three teams have purchased land in Southern California and they've drawn up plans to build stadiums. I'm sure plenty of people would be happy to see a franchise back in L.A., but from an economic perspective, does it make sense for cities to go after pro teams? KPCC's Ben Bergman ran the numbers.
There are a lot of things economists disagree on. The economic impact of sports teams isn't one of them.
If you ever had a consensus in economics, this would be it, that there is no impact.
Michael Leeds is a sports economist at Temple University, and he studied Chicago, as big a sports town as there is, with five major teams, and he found...
If every sports team in Chicago were to suddenly disappear or relocate tomorrow, the impact on the Chicago economy would be a fraction of 1%.
A two-run homer to give the Cubs the early lead.
We talk about sports a lot. We pay a lot of attention to them. But when it comes to their actual economic contribution, it's minuscule.
A baseball team has about the same impact on a community as a mid-sized department store.
And that's for a sport with 80 home games a year. NFL teams only play 8 regular season games. Still, politicians love building sports stadiums.
Yes, we will have NFL back in Los Angeles.
Carson City Councilwoman Lula Davis-Holmes spoke recently at a rally celebrating plans for a new stadium that would be built in this small city 15 miles south of downtown. Both the Chargers and the Raiders would play there. Down the freeway next to L.A.'s airport, Inglewood is trying to lure the Rams from St. Louis. So last month, its city council approved plans to build the most expensive stadium in U.S. sports history to rapturous applause. Inglewood, one of the poorest neighborhoods in L.A., projects a football stadium would generate more than $800 million worth of economic activity a year. But sports economist Victor Matheson is dubious.
Well, a good rule of thumb that economists use is take whatever the stadium boosters are telling you and just move that decimal point one place to the left, and that's usually a pretty good estimate of what you're going to get.
Economists say the biggest reason sports teams don't have much impact is they don't tend to spur new spending. Most people have a limited entertainment budget, so the money they're spending at a ball game they would have spent elsewhere, maybe even at a restaurant or small business where more dollars would have stayed in the community. Plus, Matheson says rather than draw people to a neighborhood, games can actually repel them.
Sporting events can cause significant crowds and congestion that keeps people from coming to other events in the area.
That's part of the reason why a 2003 LA City Controller's report included a surprising finding.
Economic activity in Inglewood actually increased after the Lakers left town.
Inglewood's mayor, James Butts, disagrees and says even if the economic impact doesn't turn out as well as advertised, building a stadium poses a win-win.
You know, for us, it's build it and they will come, and we actually believe that.
Butts says no public money will be used, and a 10% tax on tickets would boost the city's general fund by as much as $28 million a year, huge for a city that has teetered on the edge of bankruptcy.
There's a lot of numbers that have floated about, but whatever the numbers are, here's the bottom line. The city is protected. In every stadium deal that you look at prior to this one, the risk is borne by the city. In this case, the risk is all borne by the developers.
That's not true in Missouri, where politicians are desperately trying to keep the Rams from moving to Inglewood. The governor announced a plan that would give the team $400 million in public financing to stay. Because as politically popular as it can be to attract a team, it's seen as political suicide to let one get away. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
Every day we talk about money on this show. Maybe it's the value of the dollar. A few minutes ago, it was the size of a settlement. We talk about stock prices and the size of the federal deficit. Well, now we're going to talk about money itself, money the object, coins and currency and digital currency. Kabir Segal has written a book called Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us, and he joins us now. Hi, Kabir.
Hi, David.
Well, I want to start with what you'd think would be a pretty easy question, and I realize that it's probably not. And that's just a definitional one. What is money?
I define money really as a symbol of value, and that's a broader definition that you may expect. But the reason I defined it as that is because the part of the brain that activates when you use money is the part that is involved in symbol making. And we put symbols on our symbols. We even design our money to put artistic renderings of the things that are important to us.
Do you think that we've maybe reached a point where we don't think about all that money is? We think of it sort of as just an instrument to pay for things?
I think we have. A lot of our decision-making with money happens, what neuroscience say, the subcortical region of the brain, basically the subconscious level. For example, when you're sitting outside on a sunny day eating at a restaurant, you tip more money because of the sunlight. It makes you feel better. Whereas if you sit inside, you tip less. And then they've compared this to 26 countries in the world where on sunny days, the markets actually outperform an annualized 25% higher than on overcast days. And I use these examples in this book to show that money is really shaping our decisions when we're not really even thinking about it.
Talk to me about where we're headed when it comes to money. We hear a lot about Bitcoin and other digital currencies, and I, for one, will be sad, I think, when I reach into my wallet and there isn't something that I can hold, a piece of currency that I can use to pay for something. Is that where we're headed? Is that inevitable?
I don't think Bitcoin is the future of currency. I happen to think the future of money is in the mobile phone. There's actually something very interesting in the brain happening. When you don't see money being spent, there's less activation in your insula, meaning there's less anxiety, which is probably a good thing for consumer, for stores. They want to sell you more. And so if you don't see the money, you're just using a card or a payment, there's less activation. So it's more of a seamless transaction.
Just lastly, I want to toss to you a question that you posed at the beginning of your book. You say, what is it about money that we can't master? What is it?
Yeah. What we can't master is that our brains are not equipped to be making really financial decisions in the proper manner. For example, in the book, I talk about Harry Moskowitz, who is the inventor of portfolio theory. Basically, the guy says that, you know, when you invest in your portfolio, you should make sure that you're diversified. But then when he invested his own money, he just said, listen, I just went 50-50 and just closed my eyes and invested. And so basically this guy who's created what modern portfolio theory didn't subscribe to it. And so that goes to show you that the brain is using all kinds of shortcuts while we use this object. So money really influences our mind. It steers our body. It shapes our soul.
Kabir Segal is the author of Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. Kabir, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And there's an excerpt from Coined on our website. That is at marketplace.org. This final note, I saw this on Business Insider's site today, a piece pegged to a pledge by Russian President Vladimir Putin to reduce his salary by 10% because of the economic sanctions that have been imposed on his country. Putin's official salary, by the way, is $136,000. Business Insider compiled a list of what other world leaders make, and Barack Obama is pretty high up. His annual salary is $400,000, just above Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel. Narendra Modi of India earns about $30,000 a year. And the world leader who makes the most money is the Prime Minister of Singapore, $1.7 million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
All right, that's Marketplace for Thursday, March 19th. Today, the Dow dropped 117.6%. The Nasdaq gained 9.2%. And the S&P 500 lost 10.5%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm David Gura, and we'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.